The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Mark Weber Report. Mr. Weber is a historian, author, current affairs analyst, and director of the Institute for Historical Review. Visit the IHR at ihr.org. And now, Mark Weber.
Hello and welcome. The other week, an article appeared in The Guardian, which is probably Britain's best daily newspaper these days, by Simon Jenkins, a prominent British journalist who's written for The Guardian, The Independent, Evening Standard, and for a time was editor of The London Times, which for many years was probably the most prestigious and worthy British daily newspaper. In this article, Simon Jenkins, the article's entitled Britain's Nazi Obsession Betrays Our Insecurity. In this article, Simon Jenkins talked about this, what he calls this obsession in Britain with Hitler, the Third Reich, Nazism, and talked about how this is harmful and not good socially, politically for Britain. He made the point that Nazism is still a very, very large theme of cultural life in Britain. He says it's the favorite topic of that cultural Wild West, the video game industry. And quoted one person as saying, the number of Nazis in video games probably exceeds the number of people that have ever lived on this planet. He makes the point that in the year 2000, there were 380 English language titles on the Third Reich, adding to some 30,000 with the word Hitler in the title. And he says that last year, the tally of Hitler books rose by 850. Some 80% of these were written by Britons and published in Britain. He also makes the point of how often the subject of Hitler and Nazism comes up on the Internet. And he quoted what he calls the Goodwin Law of Nazi Analogies, invented apparently by an American named Mike Goodwin. The Law of Nazi Analogies, Jenkins says, is as any online discussion grows longer, the probability of a comparison involving Nazis or Hitler approaches 100%. He makes the point that whatever the topic, whatever the issue, almost invariably, if the discussion continues for very long, people will try to make their argument and their point by claiming that their adversary holds views similar to those of Hitler. In other words, if you can, what he calls the reductio ad Hitlerum, reduce the arguments to calling your opponents Hitlerites or Nazis. Jenkins makes the point that Goodwin's sardonic comment is all too familiar to readers of newspaper letters and blogs. It applies to any commentary on wars of intervention, especially involving Osama bin Laden, Saddam Hussein, al-Qaeda, and Gaddafi. He might have mentioned that time and again, American political leaders try to get the public to support the latest American overseas adventure will claim that the head of the government of the country that the United States is targeting for invasion or bombing is like Hitler, whether it was Saddam Hussein or Barack Obama, Muammar Gaddafi and so forth. Jenkins makes another point, though, that I disagree with. He says, or only partly agree with, he said, what is extraordinary is that the use of the Third Reich as an all-purpose metaphor for evil extends to every area of culture. Well, that's certainly true in Western society, where in our motion pictures and political leaders and so forth often use Nazism and Hitler as a metaphor for evil. But the fascination with Hitler, the Third Reich, and Nazism is much more than just a fascination or a metaphor for evil. It's much, much, much wider than that. There have been several items in the news that I think underscore, highlight this point. Just the other week, there was a big complaint by the Simon Wiesenthal Center, a major Jewish organization in Los Angeles, because a school in Thailand, apparently a Catholic school, by the way, organized a kind of Hitler festival or Nazi festival there, in which students at the school in Thailand dressed up in faux Nazi uniforms, paraded around with a big swastika flag and so forth. Now, and of course, and understandably and predictably, the Simon Wiesenthal Center complained, and the school issued dutifully an apology for this. But the important thing here I want to stress is that the school that did this didn't look at Nazism as and in this parade and festival didn't look at Nazism as a metaphor for evil. The whole tenor of this celebration was not wallowing in evil, but rather a joyful one, almost a festival-like atmosphere. And around the world, the interest in, fascination with, and even support for, or sympathy with Hitler and National Socialism isn't because the National Socialist regime, the Third Reich, is regarded as evil, but because it's regarded in a positive way, as purposeful, dynamic, life-affirming, and so forth. Just the other week, an Egyptian television station had as guests on a program several members of a new Nazi party in Egypt. Apparently this party has some 300 members, although the members of this Nazi party that were on the who were guests on this program seemed a bit confused about exactly what Nazism or National Socialism means for them. The point here is that the sympathizers and supporters of this Nazi party in Egypt didn't take the view that Hitler was evil, but rather that he was a force for good and at least in some aspects worthy of emulation. Now, that's because the image of the Third Reich and National Socialism and Hitler is a very confused one in the West. Although the Nazi Germany, Hitler's National Socialist Germany, is portrayed as evil and bad, it's very difficult to understand or accept that entirely for most people, because what's even the most superficial understanding of the era is difficult to is hard to reconcile with the image of the regime as entirely evil. It's obvious that the Hitler government was extraordinarily popular. And unlike, say, the Soviet Union, which eventually simply fell apart and collapsed, the Third Reich, the National Socialist regime in Germany, didn't fall apart. It was bludgeoned to death in World War II, ultimately by overwhelming military force of the Soviet Union and the United States above all, not because it collapsed. And in fact, the extent to which Germans supported their government, supported the regime, was an extraordinary manifestation of loyalty that has few parallels in history. It's obvious that the portrayal of the Third Reich that is presented over and over in American movies, television, and so forth as evil and sinister is a reflection not really of the objective reality, of course, of the regime, but of the obligatorily Jewish-centered view of history that is in place across the board, especially in American cultural life. Historical periods or regimes are looked at in the American media, in the American educational system, in large measure, insofar as they are considered good or bad for Jewish interests and how Jews look at the regime. So that, but around the world, in countries that do not have the same Jewish-centered cultural life and educational life that the United States has, the Third Reich and Germany and Hitler and so forth are not looked at in the same way. For example, in India, there is a tremendous amount of admiration, fascination with the Third Reich and Hitler that is surprising, even shocking for many Americans who are used to portrayals of the Third Reich as a regime of unmitigated evil. One of the major and most revered figures in India of 20th century history is Subhas Chandra Bose, who is regarded as an exemplary Indian freedom fighter who fought against British imperial rule over India. But he was a collaborator, an ally of Hitler and Nazi Germany. And partly for that reason and for other reasons as well, Subhas Chandra Bose and the Indian National Army and the Indian Provisional Government that he set up, which were allied with Germany during World War II, are looked at as a positive thing, not as a negative one. And all of this is very, very different than the portrayal and the way in which the Third Reich is presented here in the United States. This is manifest also in the continual complaints by Jewish organizations, as just happened the other day, because of the way in which souvenirs and relics from the Third Reich command large prices in auctions when they are put up for auction. And just the other day, the Jewish organizations complained that more souvenirs from Hitler and the Third Reich were being put up for auction in Britain. And this is typical of the ambivalence and the confusion. And it's much more, therefore, than, as Simon Jenkins implies in his article, that the emphasis and the fascination with the Third Reich is simply due to because the Third Reich is viewed as an evil regime that makes British people feel better because they were opponents or enemies of Germany during World War II. The way in which the Third Reich comes up continually was highlighted just the other day because of complaints about the American literary figure Gertrude Stein. There was an exhibition devoted to Gertrude Stein that just opened in San Francisco. And one person was commenting about how Gertrude Stein, although she was considered insightful and an avant-garde writer and playwright, is a more complex figure because she was also an admirer of Hitler, even though she was Jewish herself. In fact, Gertrude Stein was widely acclaimed for many years as a literary icon. She was considered a kind of monarch of the lost generation of American expatriates in Paris during the 1920s and 30s, and cultivated and influenced literary figures such as Ernest Hemingway, F. Scott Fitzgerald, and artists including Pablo Picasso and Henri Matisse. In fact, there's a famous painting of Gertrude Stein by Pablo Picasso that's been widely reproduced. Gertrude Stein's home in Paris was a mecca for writers and artists, and her own novels, memoirs, lectures, and plays, which were considered very modernistic or avant-garde, had a big influence at the time, although they are not so particularly well-remembered today. Gertrude Stein came from a wealthy German-Jewish family. She attended Radcliffe and Johns Hopkins University. But it was during the years of living in France that she made her lasting mark in the world. Now, Amazingly, even though, as I mentioned, Gertrude Stein herself was Jewish, she proposed formally in 1938 that Hitler be considered for the Nobel Peace Prize. She made the point, as did many others, that Hitler should be credited for his numerous efforts to secure lasting peace in Europe on the basis of equal rights of nations. Now, that's startling for many Americans today who are used to hearing about Hitler portrayed as the personification of evil. But in 1938 and 1939, before the outbreak of war, Hitler was viewed by millions of people as a man who had brought greater justice and equity in Europe without warfare. After Hitler assumed power in 1933, he succeeded in quickly establishing friendly or cordial relations with Poland, Italy, Hungary, and several other European nations. And he made numerous initiatives during the 1933 to 1938 period to lessen tensions in Europe, including offers of detailed proposals for mutual reductions of armaments by all the major powers. Gertrude Stein was conscious of this, and that's one of the reasons that she made this formal proposal to the Nobel Committee that Hitler be given the Nobel Peace Prize. But even earlier than that, Gertrude Stein said in an interview in 1934 that Hitler deserved the Nobel Peace Prize for having brought greater tranquility or peace to Germany after becoming chancellor in 1933. Well, all this is even more than that. Gertrude Stein and her companion and lover, Alice B. Toklas, who was also Jewish, lived in France during the entire war period, even when it was under German occupation. And Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas were friends of a prominent figure in the government of Marshal Philippe Pétain in France during that era, a man named Bernard Fay, who was the head of France's National Library, the Bibliothèque Nationale. According to a biography of Stein entitled Favored Strangers, Bernard Fay and Stein often discussed, and I'm quoting, the Führer's qualities of greatness in the years before the outbreak of war in 1939. And after the war, when Bernard Fay was put on trial as a collaborationist, Gertrude Stein and Alice Toklas remained good friends with Fay and lobbied to have him freed from prison. Well, one of the reasons that I'm mentioning Gertrude Stein is that she was very enamored of and interested in and influenced by an important Austrian Jewish psychologist and philosopher named Otto Weininger. Otto Weininger is a remarkable figure. He was the author of a book entitled Sex and Character, Geschlecht und Charakter, written in Germany. It was first published in 1903 and had a very wide influence during the 1920s and 30s and 40s. It was quickly translated into different languages and went through 30 editions. Weininger's book contrasted what he called the masculine being of Arianism and Christianity with the feminine non-being, that's his word, of Judaism. According to Weininger, Jesus was the only Jew to overcome Judaism. He thought that Judaism was a negative influence in the world, and he thought that Zionism was the negation of Judaism, because it seeks to ennoble what cannot be ennobled. He said that whereas Judaism stands for the world dispersion of Jews, Zionism strives for their ingathering. Now, this is a tremendous simplification of this very detailed book by Otto Weininger, which above all is an effort to understand the essence and the essential character of Judaism and of human self-awareness. And he a lot of the book is devoted to a discussion of our image of ourself as either masculine or feminine, and the extent to which human beings are mixtures of both masculine and feminine traits. Now, I'm mentioning this because not only was Gertrude Stein influenced by Otto Weininger, but he's continued to have an influence, and one of those who has been influenced by Weininger is another a Jewish figure of our time named Gilad Atzmon. Gilad Atzmon is a Israeli Jewish musician who lives in Britain and who is the author of a new book entitled The Wandering Jew. He's denounced by Jewish and Israelis as a self-hating Jew because of the way in which he is critical, the strong criticism he makes of Judaism as a religion and the Jewish mindset. But he gave a lecture, Gilad Atzmon did, several years ago, devoted to Otto Weininger and his book Sex and Character. And he mentions how Otto Weininger was an important influence, including on James Joyce and on other leading 20th century figures. Hitler himself was influenced and impressed with Otto Weininger. And I'm mentioning this in part because Gilad Atzmon is under tremendous fire right now for this new book, and because he's the author of this book. This book has been endorsed by John Mersheimer. John Mersheimer is an important American scholar of international affairs who, along with Stephen Walt, is the author of a very important book, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, that came out in 2007 and which has had a tremendous impact in the years since then, on helping to better understand the power and the influence of what he calls the Jewish lobby. Now, both John Mersheimer and Stephen Walt were widely and viciously attacked as anti-Semitic for their book. Their book, in fact, is an expansion of an article that had appeared a year earlier in the London Review of Books entitled The Israel Lobby. And their book, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, is an expansion of the points made in that article in the London Review of Books. Now, in the pre-internet age, that article might have appeared in the London Review of Books and been basically ignored here in the United States. But in the internet age, nothing stays confined geographically in the same way. And within minutes, or certainly within hours, of the posting of this important article in the London Review of Books in 2006, it was being circulated all over the world and widely read here in the United States and in many other countries. And the support for and interest in this article led to the led John Mersheimer and Stephen Walt to write the book, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, which, as I mentioned, has had a tremendous influence. Now, Mersheimer and Walt have been in the news recently, as I was mentioning earlier, because Mersheimer has written a blurb of endorsement for the new book by Gilad Atzmon. And much of the criticism of Mersheimer and of Atzmon is because of Atzmon's interest in and admiration for the thinking and of Otto Weininger in his book Sex and Character. And Otto Weininger is considered such a notorious figure that anybody who expresses any admiration for or fascination with or regard for the thinking of Otto Weininger is denounced himself as an anti-Semite, which is what the fate has been of both John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt for their book, but even more in the case of John Mearsheimer for endorsing the new book by Gilad Atzmon. In addition to that, Mearsheimer, his essential outlook on the power and influence and of the Israel lobby and the way it is it dictates U.S. Middle East policy was considered very controversial when it came out, but is now very widely accepted as valid and true. Well, I'll talk more about that in the second half of this broadcast of the Mark Weber Report.
Stay tuned for more of the Mark Weber Report. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Now, the UN Security Council is considering the Palestinian administration's membership for statehood. Leader Mahmoud Abbas officially submitted their United Nations application last week. Israel and the United States strongly oppose the idea. RT's Marina Portnoy is following the consultations for us in New York. Let's talk to her now. Marina, how long is this going to take and where's the smart money on how the vote will go?
Well, in terms of how long this is supposed to take, the process takes no longer than 35 days. Excuse me, that should be the maximum of which the standing committee will assess and review the application for Palestinian UN membership and statehood. The standing committee will hold its first meeting on Friday, and the application that the Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas handed in calls for a recognition of a Palestinian state in the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem as its capital. Now, so far, there is about 6 Security Council members on record that have thrown their support behind the Palestinian bid. A total of 9 out of the 15 countries need to support the application, and there has to be no vetoes. None of the veto-wielding members of the Security Council should cast a veto. As we know, the United States, a staunch ally of Israel, has vowed to veto the Palestinian bid for UN membership if it has to. Israel is very much opposed to this. The U.S., President Barack Obama, said the only way that there can be an independent Palestinian state is if the Palestinians and the Israelis get back to the negotiation table and discuss a Middle East peace plan that comes to fruition. So at this point, some critics say that the Palestinian campaign for UN membership is doomed to fail, but the Palestinians are very appreciative that the Security Council is moving so quickly. And at the very least, this is bringing attention to a problem that has lasted for decades and has not yet been solved.
Well, this consultation does come hot on the heels, doesn't it, of Israel's decision to expand their settlements in disputed East Jerusalem and build some 1,100 new homes. Where does this leave the peace process in the Middle East, such as it is?
Clearly, this makes the circumstance that much harder. There has been, condemnation coming from the international community against Israel's plan to expand its settlements. Russia has said it's deeply concerned with the plan and hopes that it would be revised. The United States and European Union also voiced criticism of this plan. Some critics say that the settlement expansion is actually a violation of international law. And if anything, Israel's actions can be seen as provoking an already sensitive circumstance. Not helping to reach.
Let's return to the Mark Weber Report, brought to you by VOR.
Welcome back. When we went on break, I was talking about the influence of the Austrian Jewish philosopher Otto Weininger in his book Sex and Character, which had an influence on the thinking and outlook of Gertrude Stein, the American Jewish writer who lived in France for many years and had a big influence especially during the 20s and 30s, and on the thinking of the Israeli Jewish writer Gilad Atzmon, who lives in Britain. And Gilad Atzmon is the author of a new book entitled The Wandering Who, which has received an endorsement from Professor John Mersheimer. Now, John Mersheimer has come under a great deal of criticism for his endorsement of this new book by Gilad Atzmon. The focus of the criticism has not been on what Mersheimer actually wrote. It's on the fact that Atzmon is allegedly a self-hating Jew and an alleged Holocaust denier, and that anybody who would endorse any writing by Gilad Atzmon must be a bad, evil anti-Semite himself. Leading the charge against Mersheimer is a ardently pro-Zionist American writer named Jeffrey Goldberg. I had a conversation with Goldberg myself several years ago, in which he wrote a short piece based on our conversation that shows that he's a liar. He deliberately distorted something I had said, but that's typical of, I think, Jeffrey Goldberg, whose support for Israel and its policies is so boundless, so great, that he'll lie to defend his interests and attack those who he considers as harmful to Israeli Zionist interests. John Mersheimer responded to Goldberg's charge that Atzmon is a Holocaust denier or an apologist for Hitler as baseless, and said that what Goldberg wrote is another example of Goldberg's longstanding effort to smear Stephen Walt and himself. In spite of the fact that Mersheimer and Walt were denounced as anti-Semites for their article on the Israel Lobby published in 2006 and the book The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, the basic validity and truth of what Mersheimer and Walt wrote in their book is now very widely accepted as self-evidently true. That is, that the pro-Israel lobby, the Jewish lobby, whatever word one wants to give, the Zionist lobby in the United States is powerful and is able to determine U.S. policy in the Middle East, even to the detriment of the interests of the United States. Just the other week, a very prominent writer for the New York Times, Thomas Friedman, mentioned in a column the power of the pro-Israel lobby and its decisive role in determining U.S. Middle East policy. And one commentator mentioned this to underscore the extent to which the thesis of Mersheimer and Walt is now mainstream, is now widely accepted. Even more to the point, I think, the commentary in recent weeks in response to the pro-Israel speech by Barack Obama at the United Nations around the world has time and time again mentioned the power of the Israel lobby or the Jewish lobby in the United States as a reason for Obama's strong reiteration of his of U.S. support for Israel and its policies, because the speech that Obama has given and his policies in the Middle East in support of Israel are so obviously contrary and in contradiction to the stated principles of the United States that the only explanation for this has to be the way in which Barack Obama, like other American political leaders, are beholden to the power of the pro-Israel Jewish lobby in the United States. And this has been widely commented on around the world. In this regard, I wanted to talk about the way in which leading Republicans have denounced Barack Obama as not being a real friend of Israel and for carrying out policies and statements, making statements that are supposedly pro-Palestinian. Now, when leading Republicans like Mitt Romney and Rick Perry say these things, they are making statements that are so obviously untrue that they can only be regarded as deliberate falsehoods. Now, more specifically, Rick Perry, who is the a governor of Texas and who is a leading contender for the Republican nomination for president in next year's election campaign, and along with Mitt Romney, have criticized Obama because Obama has said that Israel should halt Jewish settlement expansion in occupied Palestinian territory, and because Obama has said that the pre-1967 borders should be the basis of peace negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians. Rick Perry says that Obama's view that the pre-67 borders should be the starting point for negotiation is, in his words, insulting and naive. He accused Obama of a, quote, policy of appeasement toward the Palestinians and called President Obama's Middle East policy, and again I'm quoting, naive, arrogant, misguided, and dangerous. Not to be outdone, Mitt Romney, the former governor of Massachusetts and another leading Republican contender for the Republican Party presidential nomination, criticized, and again I'm quoting, President Obama's repeated efforts over 3 years to throw Israel under the bus and undermined its negotiating position. Well, this is just ridiculous. President Obama, when he was campaigning for the presidency and after, and for a while after taking office, made speeches that raised hopes among millions of people around the world that his policy, his foreign policy, would be more just and even-handed than U.S. policy has been in the past. But these expectations have given way to great disappointment. Obama's policies as president, not his words, but his policies as president, have proven to be every bit as pro-Israel as those of other American presidents. He has pledged to veto any bid by Palestinians for recognition in the United Nations as a member state. And in his recent address to the UN General Assembly, Obama was, as I mentioned, so ardently supportive of Israeli interests and policies that it earned praise even from hardline Zionists in both Israel and the U.S. In fact, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu called Obama's speech a, quote, badge of honor, unquote. Moreover, the recently appointed new U.S. ambassador to Israel, appointed by Obama, has made clear that President Obama's Middle East policies are driven by concern for Israel's security and identity as a Jewish ethno-religious state, which is another way of saying that the key to and the crucial starting point for U.S. policy in the Middle East is not what is best for the United States, but what's best for Israel. Specifically, Ambassador Daniel Shapiro, recently appointed by Obama, said, and I'm quoting, "The test of every policy the administration develops in the Middle East is whether it is consistent with the goal of ensuring Israel's future as a secure Jewish democratic state. That is a commitment that runs as a common thread through our entire government." Unquote. Well, it's hard to imagine a more open, blunt acknowledgement of the extent to which U.S. Middle East policy is determined not by what is best for America or world peace or for humanity, but by whether it is good for Israel and its interests as a Jewish state. In fact, a good argument can be made that Obama's Middle East policy is even more pro-Israel than that of President Ronald Reagan, whom most Republicans regard as their party's greatest leader in living memory. President Reagan laid out his policy on the Middle East in most detail in a very major address that he gave on September 1st, 1982. The address and the policy he laid out in this speech was called the Reagan Plan, in fact. But in this speech, he warned that, and I'm quoting, "The United States will not support the use of any additional land for the purpose of settlements during the transition period. Indeed, the immediate adoption of a settlement freeze by Israel, more than any other action, could create the confidence needed for wider participation in these talks," unquote. In other words, Reagan was saying what other American presidents, including Barack Obama, has said about settlements. Israel should not build any further settlements in occupied Palestinian land. And that's been U.S. policy pretty consistently since 1967. And Obama is merely reiterating that policy. Moreover, President Reagan went on in this 1982 speech, "America's efforts for peace in the region must be based," he said, "on United Nations Security Council Resolution 242, which calls for," and I'm quoting, "withdrawal of Israel armed forces from territories occupied," unquote, in the June 1967 war. Moreover, Security Council Resolution 242 is explicit in, and again I'm quoting, "emphasizing the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by war." Reagan went on, "We base our approach squarely on the principle that the Arab-Israeli conflict should be resolved through the negotiations involving an exchange of territory for peace. This exchange is enshrined in United Nations Security Council Resolution 242, which is in turn incorporated in all its parts in the Camp David agreements. UN Resolution 242 remains wholly valid as the foundation stone of America's Middle East peace effort. It is the United States' position that, in return for peace, the withdrawal provision of Resolution 242 applies to all fronts, including the West Bank and Gaza," unquote. Well, for Republican leaders like Rick Perry and Mitt Romney to claim that President Obama's policies are biased toward the Palestinians or are somehow hostile to Israel are so groundless that they can only be regarded as conscious falsehoods. And if these Republican critics of Obama's Middle East policy are honest or sincere or consistent, they must regard President Reagan's policy as dangerous or naive or harmful to Israel. Well, of course, Reagan was no enemy of Israel. His policies were very supportive of Israel. And Obama's policies have been, by any reasonable, rational yardstick, extremely supportive of Israel. And that the Republican candidates for the presidency who criticize Obama are motivated not by any regard for accuracy or truth, but in a obvious effort to curry favor with the organized Jewish community, the Israel lobby in the United States, for their presidential ambitions. And this is extraordinarily dangerous because it is an institutional, endemic form of corruption that puts career interests ahead of what the interests of the United States, ahead of the interests of the United States in world peace, and ahead of even basic fidelity to truth. The power of the U.S. Israel lobby, of the organized Jewish community, of the Jewish community in the United States, was reiterated again by the way in which the U.S. Holocaust Museum continues to play an important role in shaping the mentality and outlook of Americans. The U.S. Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. is an enormous museum dedicated to highlighting the oppression of non-Americans and mistreatment by non-Americans, by other non-Americans in a foreign continent. It is designed to support upholding the image of Israeli of Jews as a eternally beleaguered and oppressed people for whom the United States should show special consideration and sensitivity and support. Just recently, the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, although it receives U.S. funding and is a U.S. government institution, received a gift of $17.2 million from the estate of Eric Ross of Palm Beach, Florida, and of New Jersey, who had already given millions of dollars to the museum. But Ross was himself a Jewish refugee from Germany during the 1930s, and his gift is an expression of the very strong support that the organized Jewish community has for institutions that promote their outlook on the world and their interests. There's no comparable expression of support for institutions by non-Jews in the United States for any specific ethnic religious interests in that same way. And that's one of the reasons why the American Jewish community has the tremendous support and tremendous impact it does and tremendous power it does, because it's as focused and as self-aware as it is in a way that's very valuable. To be more blunt, there are very few American non-Jews who support organizations and institutions which are working for increasing public awareness for the interests of humanity and of the American people in the way that the more organized Jewish community supports institutions such as the Simon Wiesenthal Center, the Anti-Defamation League, and the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, which are so focused on promoting specifically Jewish interests. Another item that appeared in the news just recently was a piece in the Daily Mail in Britain on what it said was a recently revealed plan from 1930 in the United States for a contingency attack by the U.S. against Britain and Canada. The Daily Mail article said this: "Details of an amazing American military plan for an attack to wipe out a major part of the British Army are today revealed. In 1930, a mere 9 years before the outbreak of World War II, America drew up proposals known as War Plan Red, specifically aimed at eliminating all British and land forces in Canada and in the North Atlantic, thus destroying Britain's trading ability and bringing the country to its knees. Previously unparalleled troop movements were to be launched as an overture to an invasion of Canada, which was to include massive bombing raids on key industrial targets and the use of chemical weapons." Well, a couple of points about this. First of all, not only the United States, but other countries have contingency plans against many other countries. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're hostile toward those countries, but still, it's remarkable that the U.S. in 1930 would have military contingency plans for an invasion of Canada and a devastating military strike against even Britain. But the reason I'm mentioning this is not only because this is startling or interesting in itself, but because of the false point that was made in this article. And that is that this plan is only being revealed now. In fact, this secret 1930 American plan for war against Britain and Canada has been known for years. And I wrote an article in 1992 on this very point that's posted on our website. It's entitled "Secret 1930 American Plan for War Against Britain and Canada." And in it I wrote, American military officials drew up a secret plan in 1930 for war against Britain in which Canada would be the main battleground. Joint Plan Red, as it was known, envisioned the elimination of Britain as a trading rival. And I quoted the work of a professor in Canada who wrote about this. Anyway, the point is that oftentimes the media can be not only misleading, but even downright wrong when it sometimes claims that this or that report is being revealed for the first time, when in fact it's been known to specialists anyway, and even to alert non-specialists for many years before that. The another interesting item in the news recently that underscores again the power of the organized Jewish community is that Britain has amended a law in order to protect Israelis from prosecution for war crimes. Until recently, British law enabled people to bring charges before courts in Britain to have foreigners arrested for alleged war crimes. And Israeli leaders complained that the British law enabled warrants for arrest to be issued against prominent Israelis. And the result has been that prominent Israeli leaders, including Tzipi Livni, former foreign minister of Israel, and defense minister Ehud Barak, canceled trips to Britain because they were afraid they might be arrested as war criminals. In order to placate Israeli and Jewish sensibilities and interests, Britain revised its law so that such warrants could no longer be issued. The point here, though, is the way in which it was specifically Israeli concerns that made Israel that made Britain change the law. It's another example of the way in which the United States, Britain, Germany, and a number of other countries give special consideration to Jewish and Israeli interests that they do not to any other country. To put it another way, the United States and Britain, but especially the United States, hold Iran, or in the past have held Iraq, to standards that they do not apply to Israel. And if the United States held Israel to the same standards that it has held Iraq or it tries to hold Iran, the United States would be invading Israel. It would be bombing Tel Aviv and rounding up Israeli leaders and putting them on trial for war crimes and crimes against humanity. Because it's Israel alone of all the countries in the Middle East that blatantly and consistently violates international law in occupying lands of foreign countries, Syria notably, for example, and the Palestinian territories, which flaunts international standards on nuclear weapons. Israel has a large nuclear weapons arsenal that they make no pretense or even of trying to comply with international standards on its with regard to its nuclear arsenal. And there are other examples of that by Israel as well. But the United States refuses to apply the standards to other countries, to apply to Israel the standards it insists upon in the case of other countries. And this is ultimately an expression of the tremendous power that the world Jewish community, and especially the Jewish community here in the United States, has on American political life, especially with regard to foreign policy. Well, that concludes this broadcast of the Mark Weber Report, and I hope you'll join me for the next broadcast.
Thanks for listening. The Mark Weber Show returns Wednesday, 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time, only on VOR, Reason Radio Network. www.thehitlerhotline.com.